Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
All rivers at night are melancholy, sentimental, sad, like emblems of the mystery and unreality of human things. Under their spell, we seem to see things larger than our own small selves. Leonard Woolf. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you'll peruse our backlog of episodes, and if you're a returning listener, thank you guys. As always, your support, again, means a lot. So, I am not feeling great tonight. Rough weekend. Football team lost in rather embarrassing fashion due to poor coaching decisions and several key injuries. But we soldier on. I'll try to do as long of an episode as I can. But again, I think I'm also fighting off cold or something. I've been stopped up all night, so apologies if my voice sounds weird or anything like that. I'll try to clear, I'll try to make sure that that doesn't end up in the episode if I have to clear my throat or sinuses or whatever. So, please like, download, rate 5 stars, all that kind of good stuff, and please enjoy. Now, before we get to our next big focus for the next couple of weeks, I did want to go back. There are a couple of items I want to quickly talk about from last week and, you know, the episodes or two prior to that. First, I forgot to recommend two books that go much more in depth on the topics we've covered the past couple of weeks and what were two very useful and extremely entertaining, to me at least, sources that I used. These were like the biggest sources I used for Pi and a couple other things. But the first is The Horse, the Wheel, and Language, How Bronze Age Writers from the Eurasian Steppes Shaped the Modern World by Professor David Antony, and Proto, How One Ancient Language Went Global by Laura Spiney. Or Spiney, I'm not quite sure how that's pronounced. Anthony's book was released in 2007, so it is missing newer archaeological findings and DNA results, which challenges some of what he said and confirmed others, other things that he put forward. However, the level of study and research he did on horses and their evolution is incredible, and the details he went into that aspect of in that book were very impressive, and I don't think any of that has really been challenged much. Proto is brand new. It came out in March of this year. Its primary focus is language, so it doesn't have an analysis of horse evolution and breeding or as broad of a coverage of DNA and archaeology. Those subjects obviously come up, and while Spiney, again, I'm sorry, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, is primarily a journalist, she seems to have a very strong grasp of the topics she chose to cover in the books. And what's more, she explains them very easily. So if you're a pure layman, it's a great starting point. But there's enough deep analysis information that more informed readers should appreciate, too. Also, she includes some great bits from interviews she did with scholars for the book, including Colin Renfrew, who we discussed last week, and how he was initially one of the big proponents of the Anatolian hypothesis for Pi before he, well, at this point, and she acknowledges this in the book, that he agrees now with Maria Gimbutas. Another thing I wanted to make sure I brought up properly and maybe expand on a little, because I think I mentioned it last week, but one of the big words that hints that Hittite was possibly a sister tongue and not a daughter tongue of Pi is wheel. The primary Pi word for wheel was kleklos. The Hittite word was hercus. Now, Pi and its daughters had other words they used for wheel, but these were sort of euphemistic or descriptive. Something like, take the English word wheel. We also have disc, ring, circle, hoop. Now, most native English speakers would never use those when we talk about, you know, the device that moves our vehicles, or at least, you know, helps move our vehicles, but they are synonyms, technically speaking. And Pi probably also used the word rothos, which meant something like runner. So they could use the technical term, kleklos, but they could also just call them runner, which in Pi would be rothos again. That also brings me to another thing I didn't really do. Pi speakers like to use euphemisms for things, particularly like predators. They had kind of a stigma about them. They didn't want to say the name, you know, in case they actually summoned the animal by referring to them. Bears were referred to as honey eaters or honey thieves or something like that. They also would refer to them as the brown, just kind of euphemistically. Wolves were called howlers or the black. And the Pi word for wolf was lukos or wulkos. There's a little bit of a disagreement on the reconstruction of that one. And bear was hret. That is obviously related to our word wreck, as in, you know, you're in a crash, but wreck for Pi literally meant dangerous. That bears literally were dangerous. That's what they referred to them as. That was the proper name. And lukwos or wulkwos was something like danger. The Hittite word for wolf was walkua, and bear was hartaka or hartaga. So you can tell that, you know, the words for animals, very similar. The wheel, you know, which obviously was probably a later discovery. It was either independently invented for pottery. This is, again, not anything happening this season, but it's also possible that they either independently invented it or they met people who introduced it to them through trade or something like that, which is very possible. It might have come from some of the places we'll be talking about this week or come up through the Caucasus from the Middle East, which kind of leads us to our next big topic for the next week or two. And that is we're going to be covering and moving into the Eurasian Steppe as it meets its terminus at the Danube River and Carpathian Mountains to discuss the various material cultures that emerged between 6 and 4,000 BC, BCE, whichever you prefer. Everything we discussed in regards to the ebb, flow, shifts, and overlap of material cultures in the last couple of episodes, and really this entire season, holds true in this region, with some of these cultures being close neighbors, though perhaps not all at the same time. I should also reiterate that this is not a total summation of all peoples. Some cultures don't have a lot of information in English on them, or they're debated if they should even qualify as a separate culture or should belong to a different culture altogether. Or maybe, you know, again, there are still those that are practicing hunting and gathering and not leaving as much of an archaeological impact. Those people are probably aren't going to be covered too much, though there are a couple of cases where, you know, where that's not entirely the case. Also, some of these cultures are influenced from neighboring regions we haven't covered yet this season. This area, in addition to seeing some overlap with the steppe cultures in the north that we've been discussing, also had interactions with the western Anatolia Peninsula. We haven't really dived too deep on that side of Anatolia just yet. We've done like southern Anatolia, western Anatolia, eastern Anatolia. But western Anatolia, we haven't really discussed yet because they're, materially speaking, they're kind of closer to this group. And we'll be covering them, you know, in a couple of weeks. This region is home to what in some sources is referred to as the Danubian culture, which, as you may have guessed from the name, refers to the myriad of material cultures living and developing in and around the Danubian River Basin. In terms of modern countries that are covered this week, that would be Romania. Well, in this week and next week as well, and maybe the week after, that would be Romania, Moldova, Bulgaria, and a teensy bit of Ukraine. We will begin with the Caranovo culture. The name comes from the type site of Caranovo, a village in modern-day Bulgaria. I believe I mentioned it last season, but this season sees the site grow and develop and see its influence spread to a few neighboring locations as well. This is a hilltop. This is a hilltop settlement. I think at one point at its high point, it had around 18 houses or buildings. Some of them may not have been houses. And they probably had somewhere to, you know, right around 100 or so inhabitants kind of at its high point. And again, during this season, we'll begin to kind of see other settlements adopt very similar pottery and things like that, that kind of show that there are links to Caranovo. It showed links to Caranovo is the earliest site that kind of shows these, their type of pottery and things like that. And then, you know, the later sites come along a little bit later, of course, duh. Caranovo is actually occupied pretty continuously as a small village right up until around the second millennium BC. But at that point, the Caranovo culture has been replaced by another material culture that we'll discuss later, but the Caranovo culture lasts right up until the end of this season. Also, I need to kind of rephrase something. When I say more or less continuously, there are periods where it was abandoned for maybe, you know, 100 years or so, but it's, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that long that it's abandoned. But the sixth period of the Caranovo culture, or the sixth phase, ends around 4000 BC, and it's abandoned. We're not sure why. There's no signs of conquest or destruction at the village. They abandoned it, and then, you know, a couple hundred years later, someone else comes along and reestablishes a community. We don't know, obviously, if they were aware of people living there before. Probably not. But that's, again, done by a different material culture. Their pottery is extremely well made, and they are very simplistic in their choices of coloring. It's either white painted pottery or black painted pottery. In some cases, they combine the two and create these really bold lines. They definitely had their own aesthetic, and it, you know, It very much stands out from some of the other early pottery places that we've seen in other areas. So it's likely that the people that initially moved there adopted pottery very early. It may have even been founded by people who already knew how to create pottery. They also created ceramic figures of humans. People think that these are some type of fertility devices. There's a pair of a terracotta statue called the Lovers, Or they also made vessels in these kind of these weird, kind of vaguely human-esque faces, and then they have this weird shape. They did vessels shaped like animals. They also worked jade. Jade's not super abundant there, but you know, there are some sources of jade where they were living. One of the jade pieces I saw, there's it reminded me a little bit of the Trinacria, which if you've never seen it, it's a symbol for, like, you'll see on Sicilian flags sometimes. It's like three legs, kind of like they're almost running. It's three. The jade amulet was four, but that's kind of what I saw when I first looked at it. But I guess it could also be like some kind of a snake symbol, like a four-headed snake, maybe. It could also be, you know, it could easily be something else. I'm not sure. I was trying to find information on it, but unfortunately, I didn't find anything specifically mentioning that. But for whatever reason, that just struck me like when I first saw it. And I'll try to remember to put that image in when I'm doing the video for the YouTube side of things. The Carnovo are agricultural peoples. Moving on to the next culture, it's contemporaneous with the...
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert-guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Start of the Carnovo culture. This is the Dudeshti culture. And the name comes from the Dudeshti quarter of Bucharest. It was originally a small village kind of on the outskirts of the city that was eventually absorbed as Bucharest grew. The name is from a Wallachian noble family. It may be translated as something like mulberry or mulberry tree. Dud is mulberry tree, and eshti is like it's a plural possessive suffix. You'll see it a lot of Romanian place names. There isn't much I could find about this culture, but I was able to see that they did have permanent settlements with semi-subterranean pit houses. They primarily practiced agriculture with some herding along... though, of course, they still hunted and gathered to a smaller degree. They were descendants of Neolithic people from Anatolia, though we're not sure if their ancestors came to the region directly or if they were descendants of Anatolians who had lived a few generations in the southern Balkans. And then, you know, somewhere maybe from modern-day Bulgaria or Greece, and then they moved north. Their pottery is very simple. It's well made, and it tends to be dark brown or gray, and a lot of pieces don't have decoration, or if they do, they're just simple, shallow lines. And I saw some speculation that this was actually not an artistic choice, but just an effect of how they were making their pottery. So, not quite as skilled at the pottery making as their contemporaries in the Carnovo culture. Now, the dates for the Dudeshti vary, but they probably emerged sometime between 5800 and, 5800 and 5600 BC. Now, the Dudeshti do not last very long. After a couple hundred years, well, anywhere between, again, it depends on when they started, but anywhere between 600 and 400 years, after the Dudeshti show up in the archaeological record, you begin to see a rapid change in their material culture. And this new phase is known as the Hamangia culture. And this is kind of towards the coast. The Caranovo are more inland group. They do have some coastal settlements kind of on the Aegean Sea to the south. The Hamangia they occupy a much smaller area, kind of to the south of the Danube along the Black Sea coast to right to the north of the Bosphorus. They don't actually reach the Bosphorus directly. But the Hamangia culture kind of ups everything that the Dudeshti were doing in terms of pottery. Their pottery is much better made, and they embrace the a much more artistic and aesthetic style. Most of their pottery is brown, but they do have a lot more decoration in terms of they use lines, sharp lines, not quite as wide as the lines that the Caranovo culture used. They also don't paint their pottery as white, but they do have a lot of humanoid figures that they're creating. There's one of a what appears to be a man kind of thinking in a thinking pose. It looks like he's sitting on like a stool or something, and then he's got his legs on the ground, and he's holding his hand or his head in his two hands. There's also a what is assumed to be a female figure with a very broad posterior, and she's kind of sitting on the ground with one knee raised, and she's got two of her hands on the raised knee while her other leg is kind of flat and straight. They also have some life-size clay heads that they were making, as well as anthropomorphic pottery as well. So, you know, pottery designed to look like human features. They also buried their dead with grave goods. They found them with jewelry, some of it made from bone, some of it made from shells, things like that. The name comes from the initial site where the culture was discovered. It's Baia Hamangia. I could not get an etymology for this one, but I think the biggest site that they have, kind of their type site, like the ideal of the Hamangia culture, was at a place called Duran Kulak. And they last from about 5,200 to about 4,500. So they're contemporaries with the Caranovo as well. And in fact, the Dudeshti may have been influenced by the Caranovo. There's definitely areas for trade or even conflict between those groups, though. Again, how much of that there is, it's hard to say. But the Hamangia do practice agriculture. Their homes were wattle and daub, though some of their homes did have stone foundations, and they were rectangular. I didn't see any notes about them practicing any herding. I'm assuming they had some animals, but most of their settlements are along the coast, and they also preferred to live near rivers and lakes as well. So the fishing is definitely a part of their economy too, probably much more so than the Caranovo. Now, as I said, the Hamangia last about 4,500. Then their sites are abandoned, or you see them shrinking in size by quite a large extent. Why that happens, we're not really sure. It could be there's a climate issue. I think at that point it may have been, there may have been flooding. There could have also just been, it was a little bit colder. But a couple hundred years later, descendants from the Hamangia mixed with some people coming from the east, from the west. These are known as the Eastern Linear Pottery people. We'll talk about them later. But this new culture is known as the Marita culture, or the Giuleschi Marita culture, or the Boyan culture. Depending on what country you're in, you know, it's called different things. I think on Wikipedia, they show up as the Boyan culture. Their pottery is, if you look at it side by side with the Hamangia, you can definitely see influences there. So if they're not descendants, which again, it appears that they are, they were very heavily influenced by the Hamangia artistic style. They're a little bit further north than the Hamangia. They go north of the Danube. Their settlements are typically coastal, but they did live closer to some forests, which they were probably using for fuel as well as a source for game. Their economy seems a lot more diverse than the Hamangia. The Merida have, in addition to agriculture and fishing, they also have a lot of evidence of them hunting waterfowl, things like that. They hunted aurochs, not cattle. Obviously, they kept their cattle, but they also hunted wolf, goats, or not goats, deer, beaver, and badgers. They had a lot more variety in their diet, it appears. And there's even some evidence, and I couldn't get an exact date, but there is some evidence that they had gotten copper as well. Though how deep they were in metallurgy, that's a little harder to say. There doesn't appear to be much evidence of them smelting copper, but they at the very least had contact with people who did smelt, which again, I don't think is happening during the season. But the Merida culture will last until... they'll last into next season. They last from about 4,300 to about 3,500 BC. Now, the culture that they may have gotten metallurgy or copper from is known as the Gumelnita culture. And this is a firmly Chalcolithic culture as well as Neolithic. But it lasts from about 4,700 to about 4,000 BC. It's named after the Gumelnita site on the left bank of the Danube. So it's to the north and west of the Danube River. And there's some overlap between the area that the Gumelnita and the Maurita cultures lived in. So they're very close neighbors. Some maps don't even show the Maurita culture because, in geographically speaking, it's not that large in terms of number of sites. It's a very regional culture. But the Gumelnita, they overlap with the Varna as well as the Cucuteni Tripolie culture, which we'll be discussing next week. But again, they last from about 4,700 to about 3,900, give or take half a century or so. Some do kind of posit that the Gumelnita and the Caranovo, or at least the very end of the Caranovo, kind of overlap more, that they actually may be more closely related to each other, and that they show up in what is known as the Varna culture, that these two groups may have combined together. But we'll discuss the Varna and the Cucuteni Tripolie cultures next week. The Gumelnita pottery is fairly different from what the other cultures we've talked about. Most of their pottery is brown, but they paint it with white and red as opposed to white and black. they had specific buildings that were workshops and not just homes. They also have quite a wide range of ceramic figures of animals. There's a boar's head that I saw, or at least I think it's a boar. It could be, I guess, like a cow. They also have their own thinker. It's like a kind of like a figure that doesn't have a head, but it's a female figure. It's kind of standing with its arms kind of over its belly. I think it's more like it doesn't really look like a thinker compared to the other one. It looks more like a woman kind of holding her belly. Maybe she's pregnant. I don't know. They also have some depictions of a person carrying a pot on their head. Something that probably people would do back in their day. So they're depicting, you know, everyday scenes as well. They also have some figures with kind of outstretched arms, like, you know, if you're familiar with the term, praising the sun almost, though, again, may not be sun worship, but it's kind of that pose. They also, of course, have, again, they do have copper. They make copper axes, though, again, I don't know that that's happening during this season per se, though I guess it kind of has to because they end right around 4,000. So they're very much on the cutting edge of metallurgy. They also have gold ornaments as well that have been found at some of their sites. So they're very much on the cutting edge of the Copper Age coming in. And, you know, some of their goods show up in other places that we'll be discussing next week. But yeah, so that I think will be that for this week. Next week we'll discuss the Varna culture, the Cucutani Tripolye culture, and there are a couple of others that will probably get kind of thrown in with them as well. But yeah. I hope you guys have enjoyed. I hope you found this entertaining and informative. Please like, download, subscribe, rate 5 stars, all that kind of good stuff. We're sitting at 340 on YouTube, getting ever closer to, hopefully, monetization there. I am going to keep the ads on. I've decided after looking at numbers, it's not a lot of money, but it does help. And, eventually I hope to have enough to actually put back in the show, maybe get a better microphone, hopefully get a little bit more help with the video editing side of things for YouTube, so I don't have to use the free ClipChamp. I'm trying to learn a little bit more about editing just kind of in my spare time, as well as, you know, putting in money for books and all that is helpful too. But yeah, I appreciate you all for your time and your interest in the show. It means a lot. I hope you will all return next week for our next episode. And if you guys have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please feel free to reach out to me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also direct message me on X or Twitter. You can also comment on the YouTube videos, and I will reply there as quickly as I can. But I hope you all have a good day and rest of your week from whenever you're listening to this, and I will see you all next time. Peace.